Interesting title, huh? Currency of Relationships. I'll give credit where credit is due. The inspiration for this in large part comes from Shivaram Maharaj in a discussion that I had with him about, well, this same as this seminar that, or conference, I should say, Building Bridges Conference is going to be held here over Easter weekend. How to make our Krishna conscious message relatable to people who don't know anything about Krishna consciousness. How to make it smooth and juicy and approachable and easy. So, catchy title, and we're going to give credit to Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, but make them very, very approachable to our audience, Western audience, largely. So, currency of relationships. Relationships, when we think of relationships, it's not about something material. When we think of currency, we think of something material. The currency of relationships. These terms will be defined in the course of the presentation, and especially with the Western audience, being bold enough to say a pure relationship and an impure relationship, that's challenging their political correctness. So that's the title, Pure and Impure. This presentation is based upon the teachings of these two wonderful acharyas, members of our disciplic succession, Sanatana Goswami and Rupa Goswami. Sanatana Goswami being the elder brother and the respected. Rupa Goswami treated his elder brother like spiritual master. Sanatana Goswami is our acharya for Sambandha Gyan or Sambandha Tattva, that knowledge about the relationship of all things with the personality of Godhead, who is the source of all things. And then his younger brother in the foreground, Rupa Goswami, who is our acharya for Abhideya Gyan, or Abhideya Tattva, that knowledge dealing with when you act within that relationship, your relationship with the Supreme, what is that made up of? So, we're offering our obeisances to Sanatana and Rupa Goswami, especially Rupa Goswami, because the language here is not what our Western audience, well, is what our Western audience can relate to, but the knowledge comes from Rupa Goswami. So, we'll start with a very simple approach by defining what is a relationship. Oh, one of the reasons for selecting the title is, I shared with Shivaram Maharaj, relationship is one of those buzz topics. Like I shared with him that I got something in the mail that said, bank at our bank where relationships are everything. I said, yeah, right. The relationship is I give you my money and you say thank you. Well, relationships are everything. So it's a marketing thing because people are concerned about relationships, naturally, especially in our current time. So what is a relationship? Simple definition. The common basis of interaction between two or more people. Hardly is that a challengeable definition. Very simple. Common basis of interaction between two or more people. We're going to now look closely at each of the terms in this definition. Common basis, interaction, and so forth. Common basis. What's a common basis? Common basis means there is a commodity of exchange. Any MBAs out here in the audience? Commodity, exchange, know that term, right? Some persons are smiling. So just commodity of exchange. That's know, let's say going to a very old system where it's a bartering system. I grow rice because I'm a rice farmer and I want somebody to put a new door on my house, so here's 2 bags of rice. Will you take care of putting a new door on my house? And he says, oh, I only need 1 bag. That's all I need for my family, so I'll put a new door on your house. And so there's some kind of currency that you both agree upon. That's the currency of exchange, or gold, or paper currency, or promissory notes, or whatever it is, where two parties agree, there's this currency that we agree upon. Then you have a common basis. If you don't have a common basis, there's no way to relate, or there's no relationship, or at best a dysfunctional relationship. You have to have a common basis to have a relationship. And then exchange. This gets into the Rupa Goswami area. Exchange implies while both an object and subject and object in the relationship, the roles alternate back and forth. That's the exchange part. We're going to define these terms, subject and object. The object, you don't see that little baby in the crib, but he or she is there. That's the object. The object is the person to whom action or feeling is directed. All six are huddled around that baby crib and they're giving feelings and acting in relation to that object. And the subject is the person who acts or feels. Or in Rupa Goswami's language, those of you that are accustomed to or familiar with Nectar of Devotion, Ashraya and Vishaya. Ashraya is the subject and Vishaya is the object. Alternating roles means we take turns. Sometimes one is the object and the other is the subject. Sometimes it's the other way around. So it's alternating roles. Was the commodity exchange in those alternating roles? It's emotion. Emotion is that primary commodity, a consequence of which is action. Pretty simple so far, right? Now, taking Rupa Goswami's teaching and making it simple for a Western audience, emotion is of 8 kinds. It's primary and secondary. Primary rasas and secondary rasas. But we're just saying. Primary emotion is love. And the secondary emotion, these are also emotions, amazement, humor, chivalry, compassion, fury, fear, and dread. Now, what I have understood from Rupa Goswami's use of these terms, go a little bit down that path for a moment. They're terms that come from the Vedic science of drama. Maybe some of the devotees here who are Prabhupada disciples remember when Tamal Krishnamurti really got into studying drama. He studied and studied, because when Tamal Krishnamurti did something, he didn't 10%, 50%, 80%, it was 100%. He studied Vedic drama, and then he wrote a drama. Remember Jagannath Priya Natakam? Did you see that performance in Mayapur? Huh?
We have a copy of it.
I attended the performance, and it did exactly what drama is supposed to do. Vedic drama, it's a science of how to churn or stir or awaken emotions, of course, in relation to Krishna. Because that's what Vedic means, in relation to Krishna. So, different stimulus would create a stirred emotion. You combine different stimuluses and really stir that emotion, and you get the audience crying and laughing and feeling feelings in relation to Krishna that are profound. I mean, I attended that drama. I was expecting it to be, you know, like many of the dramas, nice, but not, you just got swept away in a ocean of emotion. Especially, I can remember, because they had the dramatists from Calcutta that came, and then an orchestra, a whole orchestra of musicians that, according to the particular mood that he wanted to create to the drama, they would play certain ragas in certain tempos, and certain particular instruments would accentuate a particular emotion. And everyone was floating and sailing and sobbing and laughing and just carried away, ecstatic in relation to the discovery of, and then the loss of, the Nila Madhava deity of King Indradumna. I mean, I especially remember when it was big crescendo, and he was going to see the deity of Nila Madhava, and they opened these doors, and the deity was gone. And the music was going, and then, oh, the whole thing, everyone was crying and crying. I was crying like a baby. I went three times. Because it was emotion in relation to Krishna. It was profound experience. So there's language of those emotions that Rupa Goswami uses in relation to the types of emotion that exist in relationships, primary and secondary. So here's the primary emotion, love, of five kinds. You all know these. Neutral, servitorship, friendship, parental, and conjugal love. We'll see these pictures again, so we'll come back. Now, in a loving relationship, there's the person who loves, that's the subject, and the person who's being loved, that's the object of love. Now, in these aspects of love, there's character, or five kinds of emotion, that's the five rasas, and there's also quality, that's where pure and impure comes in. So, here we go. Character of love in neutrality is passive. Picture here is a group of students sitting at their desk, and there's some relationship. They're attending the same class, and they're sitting in a row, and they're paying attention to their work, hopefully. But there's not much interaction. It's just passive. But then supposing one of the students during the lecture says, I missed the point the professor gave. Could you tell me what that point was? I want to make sure I get it in my notes. Or it's exam time. The professor's not looking what's the answer to question number 3. And they say, here's the answer. So it's some service. Beyond neutrality, there's some act of service. And when service becomes very confident in intimacy, then friendship. Plus service and neutrality. And parental is where in some relationship that intimacy becomes so strong that... The answer is very nice. Very simple formula. Both parties see themselves as subject in relation to the common object. Common object being God. And so, subject A and subject B, whether it's friend and friend, or husband and wife, or whatever it is, the two parties that are in the relationship, they agree that God is the object of our affection, and we are together relating to God in a compatible or harmonious way. That lends to a pure, long-lasting and rewarding relationship. Here's our
comparison. Of course, from Srimad Bhagavatam, the example of watering the root of a tree. If we find that center of existence, in the case of the tree, the root of the tree that nourishes the entire tree, and we give our attention to the root of the tree, give water there, then all the leaves and branches and twigs and all the parts of the tree will benefit. And same in relationships. If we give our primary emotion to God, and here's another person who's giving their primary emotion to God, and together we're assisting one another or sharing with one another that common object, then the satisfaction of God is achieved and our satisfaction is achieved. I made this little drawing holistic approach with God and, of course, us and God at the center. And then concentric circles going out. We have our spiritual guides that we're very closely relating with in our family and extended family and society and keep going out. But in all cases, everything is nurtured or nourished from that center point. And if that center point is missing, then we have an impure relationship or unsustainable relationship. The illustration of a photograph of a drop, something hitting body of water. The very first lecture I heard Srila Prabhupada speak was on this point, and I'd like to share that with you. It's fitting very much for this topic. When I heard Prabhupada speak it, I couldn't understand it because I wasn't used to hearing Prabhupada speak, and he had recently come to America, so I couldn't. I had to listen to a recording about 5 times before I could understand all of what he said. But hearing it again and again, and the profound nature, it's simple but profound nature of what he said, it stuck. Prabhupada with his hand made a gesture, like imagine that in the middle of the floor we have a pond of water. And we gave each person in the room a little pebble. And we said to one, can you take your pebble and on the count of three toss it into the water and tell us what happens. Toss the pebble in the water and this is what happens, a little splash. And concentric circles form that go out. And that's very nice. Aesthetically, very nice. And then you say, okay, can you throw your pebble into the water and see what happens? And same thing happens. It hits the water, a little splash, and concentric circles go out. And it's all very nice until the concentric circles hit the other concentric circles, and then you have a clash. And then you say, okay, everybody in the room, on the count of three, throw your water into the pebble. One, two, three. And what happens? So many concentric circles, so much clashing, and so much chaos on the surface of the water. Okay, now everyone else gets a pebble again. And we're going to take a common center, a place to each place our little pebble, and we'll place our pebble there. Let's do that. What happens? There's no clash. In fact, the concentric circles amplify one another. And it's very nice. In the same way, we preserve our individuality in God consciousness, but that individuality amplifies with unity the efforts of everyone else. So there's unity in diversity by that method. I'll share a little anecdotal story about this. Two anecdotal stories. Around Thanksgiving time, I was in New York and I was going to be paying a visit to Gita Nagari on the way. I was going to stop in the Harrisburg. They have a little center that's coming up in Harrisburg. So I was on a train going from New York City to Harrisburg. So the train pulled into the station in Philadelphia, and many people got out, a bunch of new people got on, and it was packed going from Philadelphia to Harrisburg, and I was on an aisle seat. There was an empty space, so a lady in her 50s wearing a Harinam chadar sat down next to me. And I was busy doing my, you know, catching up on my email and my thing. So she was being very patient, and she, after a certain point, she couldn't resist, and she said, excuse me, are you with a religious organization? And I said, yes. And she said, are you heading for an ashram? And I said, as a matter of fact, I am. And she was, you know, one of these very talkative types of people. She said, I used to live in an ashram, too. And I said, oh, really, where? She said, West Virginia. I thought, oh, New Vrindavan. Was it in Wheeling? She said, no, it wasn't in Wheeling. She gave the name of the place. And I said, what kind of an ashram was it? She said, macrobiotic. So some people here know what macrobiotic is. Rukmini's smiling, she knows what it is. It was during the counterculture days. It was a way of, it was kind of like a, quote, spiritual thing where you kind of got tuned in to yin-yang and learned about, you eat indigenous food only grown during the season, and you don't eat other things imported, and certain ways of mixing your foods and stuff like that. It was like part of the religion. At least macrobiotic diet was a way of getting more spiritual. So I said, what happened? How long did you stay there? She said, oh, after some time, the whole community fell apart. I said, really? What happened? She said, well, everyone got together initially with, you know, this one idea, but after some time, that idea started to, other people got other ideas. So I said, then what happened? She said, I left, and I went to New York and joined another ashram. The something-something yoga ashram. I said, oh, and what happened there? She said, after some time, I moved back here to Pennsylvania, and I've been keeping up on my yoga, and can you tell me a little bit about your ashram? And I said, sure. I said, something that my spiritual master taught us is you can't artificially create a center unless it's spiritual, unless it's like, it's, you know, of substance. Not just we get together and agree on some ism, and then we do that ism for a while, and after a while the ism isn't fun anymore, so we go out and do something else. We get another ism, and then another ism. But something that's really substantial is where God is at the center. And it's not just an idea of God, but something that's founded in scriptures. She was going, yeah, I know what you mean. I really like this. This is very nice. Where would I find this ashram? So I gave her the address of Iranagiri. She said, I'll see if I can get my friend to go there. Because I live near Pennsylvania, or near Philadelphia. I don't live so close to mid-Pennsylvania. So there's an address in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. Here's the address in Philadelphia. Oh, there's an ashram in Philadelphia. Yes. The idea here is, if you artificially create the center because you want this unity in diversity, it won't endure unless it's pure, unless it's actually based in the spiritual conception of who we really are and who God really is, and then it's enduring. The principle endures. And if you don't have the principle, without God in the center, conflicts are inevitable in mundane relationships. You have two centers, and two wills, and two sets of senses, and two minds, and very quickly you get a conflict. Or to speak of the whole population of the world is in great conflict. It's Kali Yuga. So this is what we want. God at the center, the object, and we're the subjects. Just like the king and his subjects. He's the king of kings, and we're the subjects. Does it matter what religion we profess for relationships to work? No. The religions must simply have a clear concept. For soul, not this body. The body is the dress of the soul. God is the supreme person and we're servants. Whatever name, the ism isn't important. Those fundamental principles When they're there, you can have pure relationships where the currency is love. It's the emotion of transcendental love. So this brief analysis, this is Bhagavad Gita's message, Krishna speaking to Arjuna, and those teachings as they've been given to us by Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami. So we really want to encourage everyone in the world to understand these principles and apply these principles in their life and have pure relationships. Last two slides. This was shared by Mantrini. Mantrini is the wife of Tamahar Prabhu, who was the Child Protection Office Director. And Tamahar and Mantrini both have degrees in marriage counseling. They have degrees. They were doing it professionally before they are now. Now they're full-time engaged in devotional service in our movement. Before that, they were full-time engaged, and then they got their degree. So Mantrini shared with me, she was giving some marital counseling to a couple that I know, and I said, wow, you did magic. And they were telling me, you did magic. And then she said, here's the magic. It's the last line. She said, of course, the willingness of two persons that are having a conflict in their relationship requires their desire to get beyond conflict. But it applies this principle. It's nice. Mother Teresa, I'll make a copy available to Anutma, and you can pester Anutma if you want a copy. Is that right, Anutma?
Yes.
Okay. People are often unreasonable, irrational, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you can win some unfaithful friends and some genuine enemies. Succeed anyway. If you're honest and sincere, people may deceive you. Be honest and sincere anyway. What you spend years creating, others could destroy overnight. Create anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, some may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today will often be forgotten. Do good anyway. Give the best you have, and it will never be enough. Give your best anyway, the final part. In the final analysis, it's between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. So Mantrini shared, this last line helped in a relationship that was not going well because they had forgotten that it's about our relationship with God anyway. He's the object. Of course we have love for one another, but when we forget God, the object, and then it becomes, you know, I want to be the object more than you are. And anyway, etc. On my terms, that's what being the object means. So, this last is a little video, and it's a, it's nice, a devotee put it together to finish this little presentation, and it's promoting nice relationships and promoting Srila Prabhupada. Thank you. 3 minutes per question. I'm obedient to the timekeeper. Yes. By Hari.
Guru Maharaj, when you were talking about concentric circles, the assumption is that...
I'll repeat the question. Concentric circles?
The assumption is that both the people agree that the center is common. What if they don't agree? That even if it's not possible...
That's right. One can strive, but you're going to end up in clashes. The two pebbles, and you're going to end up in clash. When you have individuality, even with God-centeredness, there may be differences, but the differences are resolved by that God-centeredness. On the strength of that common object, the two subjects learn to resolve differences. Anutama, go ahead. We're done. Okay, one more. Yes, by needing.
I have a question. You can test what you just said. Now, recently I was preaching to some young people who are all vegans.
Young people who are vegans?
Right. Yes.
I'm just repeating so they can hear.
And, you know, we know that the cow's milk in general, especially in the United States, is very much contaminated with fish oil and so many things, unless we get it from our devotee farms.
Right.
But, these young people, they're very idealistic. And they're
vegans are very idealistic. I'm just repeating for their...
And they're finding it very difficult to understand why we as devotees...
Why as we devotees drink milk when there is products of violence in that milk? What does that have to do with this? What does it have to do with this?
Well, so in terms of preaching, you know, because you're trying to create concentric circles of the green people at the same time, because there's some point to it, but at the same time, we're not against milk, obviously, but I just want to know what point to ask you.
I can say how I respond to that question, and I don't know if it's going to be satisfying to every vegan on the planet, but I can say how I respond to that question. Be a vegan. Offer whatever it is that's offerable to Krishna. And we're offering milk to Krishna because of two reasons. More than two reasons, but... Two reasons. One is, we don't want Mother Cow to be deprived of her opportunity to serve Krishna. Her opportunity to serve Krishna, she gives milk and we offer it to Krishna. We want her to benefit by that offering to Krishna. Because someone comes along and does something else, we don't want to deprive her of that opportunity. That's our human responsibility to Mother Cow. And second reason is our spiritual master, knowing that, of course, it's in his books profusely that this is what goes on in this Western culture, and increasing now even in Eastern culture, certainly in Western culture. What he instructed us was offer milk to Krishna and create farms that protect cows. Show by example, here's what you should do. You should protect cows and do it genuinely, not just say, oh, somebody out there is doing it so I can take care of my responsibility. Take that responsibility. Give effort and energy to protect cows. What we want to do is elevate society. We also want to elevate Mother Cow. We're not going to deprive either. But you're unhappy with that because you're a hardcore vegan. Fine, be a hardcore vegan. All those foods that you eat, please put Krishna at the center. Please offer all those things to Krishna. Thank you very much. Most of them don't like that idea, but that's my response. I want to be obedient to our officers here. One more question, okay.
Maharaj, I think one of your last slides, you mentioned you were underscoring the point about that it's not necessarily that you have to be of the
right
of the same religion, but if you have these general principles that we're all servants of God, then you can have pure relationships.
Yes.
Would you say that principle is primary to all the secondary, to all the other things that differentiate religions? That
yes.
If you think about yes. Christianity, there's so many different
yes. 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 Then it takes, is that clearly what the teaching is? And is that clearly the spirit of that teaching is how people are living? And then the answer is yes. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Like, you know, so many examples. Prabhupada speaking with Cardinal Daniel Yu and his saying, animals have no soul. Right? And Prabhupada saying, where's that in the Bible? And no answer, just, you know, animals don't have soul because they don't have reason. And humans have reason, and therefore reason is the soul, I guess. And so humans have soul and animals don't have soul. Anyway, so it doesn't matter what ism, it matters that those principles are there.